word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our culture loathes boredom. We surround ourselves with devices to access entertainment, diversions, and the lives of others. That's why news of the recent boring conference in London caught our attention. What on earth do they talk about there, we wondered? Muzak? Convenience store design? Checkers? The existential state of being bored has been around for a long time, but the word first appeared in the 19th century, and scientists didn't study boredom until the last century, and then to better understand the tedium experienced by factory workers. Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie is a freelance writer who wrote a scintillating history of boredom for Smithsonian.com and is on the line from London with more. Linda, great to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, kind of a funny origin story to the Boring Conference. Can you go over it for us?
Well, the guy who started the Boring Conference is a guy called James Ward, and he sort of developed a following with his I Like Boring Things blog. About, I think, in 2010, there was an interesting conference. So there's another conference called Interesting, and unfortunately it was canceled. And he joked on his blog and on Twitter that he should start a boring conference. Never joke on the internet about something that he might actually have to do, because within about a half an hour, it became a thing. In fact, some of the people from the Interesting Conference actually just sort of rehashed their talk for the Boring Conference.
Did you go to the Boring Conference?
I did. I did go to the Boring Conference this year.
Well, and what did they talk about?
Well, it was interesting. I have to say, it was pretty interesting. I showed up at around the middle of the day and got there for a talk on the Yamaha PSR 175 portable keyboard, which was very funny. And I think I got there for the sort of tail end of a talk on Denny's restaurants I have known, which was interesting and also kind of made me a little bit hungry because it was right before lunch.
So it is all kind of played for irony, is that your guess? Or were they really talking about boredom?
They were less talking about boredom and more about things that might on the face of it seem a bit mundane and trivial and uninteresting, but that if you really look at it, actually have something more to say. And when I spoke with James Ward, that was one of the points that he made, that it really wasn't about irony so much as it was about being interested in the world around you, which I thought was a really nice thing to think about, you know, especially now that we're sort of, you know, so tied to our phones and smartphones and computers and things, and you can kind of become somewhat insular even in your own attention span. And this is about looking at smaller things and sort of less important, less interesting, scintillating things and finding the interest in them.
Well, one of the things that you have been working on is the history of boredom. When did we first see evidence of boredom?
Well, I think that we've always had evidence of boredom. I think my personal feeling is that boredom has always existed, but we didn't really have a good word for it, for the state at least, until Charles Dickens in Bleak House talked about boredom. Now, before that, there were words like bored and people talked about being bored. But I have to say that I think that it has to have existed much earlier. I mean, you know, all the sort of graffiti on Roman walls has to indicate that kids and adults were suffering from boredom way back then. Now, there is actually a school of thought, and this tends to be sort of more of a literary historical approach, but that it didn't really exist until the Enlightenment, when people began to question their place in the sort of great chain of being. It has a lot of merits to it, but I really think that boredom, just like love and hate and anger and all of those things, has existed for a really long time.
It does seem like there are a lot of characters in literature who were bored or restless, let's put it that way.
Oh, certainly. And that really comes out, I think, in the 19th century and the 18th century. Certainly some of the more famous ones like Madame Bovary, and you could even argue Anna Karenina, and people who are put in situations where they're unable to do what they want to do, or they don't even know what they want to do, then they get bored. And that can have some devastating consequences if you ask a 19th century writer.
Well, it's interesting because there is almost this kind of moralistic aspect to it. I mean, the Puritan work ethic certainly means there's always something to do. Reflected, I would say, by my mother's intolerance for being told that we were bored. You know, there's this sort of idea that idle hands are the devil's workshop, that there's trouble behind boredom.
There is absolutely a lot of that. I mean, I certainly feel it now. You know, I'm a relatively new mom, and every second that I have downtime when I'm not taking care of my son or working, I'm doing something. I have to be doing something. I can't let myself be bored. But it's really interesting to see how deeply ingrained in the Christian tradition the understanding of boredom is. In the 4th century, and I think even a little bit earlier, there was this understanding of a sin, basically, called acedia. It's been called the noonday demon or the noontide demon, and it described a state that hermits and monks and people who sort of led very cloistered lives fell into, where they were restless and yet they couldn't figure out what they wanted to do. And it sounded like boredom, but it also sounded like depression. It's interesting to see that acedia morphs into this understanding of sloth or idleness, that rather than it being something that's sort of the noonday demon that feels like an external thing that's happening to you, the Puritans sort of internalized it and turned it into a sin, and that, you know, if you weren't doing something, it was your own fault. And, you know, the devil does make work for idle hands.
I'd like to hear more about that connection between depression and boredom, because I think for many people, it can be a sort of debilitating state. Do scientists actually know what's happening in our brains when we are bored?
They don't entirely. And there are links between boredom and depression and boredom and anxiety disorders and eating disorders and a lot of sort of psychosocial problems. But what's difficult to parse out is how boredom is related to, say, for example, depression. They are two actually very distinct states, and that does have serious implications for how you treat these sort of psychological issues. I mean, certainly there is a sense that there's a difference between, say, you know, the boredom that you feel as a kid when you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, mom, I'm bored, and the kind of deeper boredom that has you questioning your very existence and why you're on this planet. But there's also an idea that those really are a little bit more linked than we think they are, and that how we deal with boredom can have some clues as to how our brains are made up. A neuropsychologist from Canada, Dr. John Eastwood, came up with a new theory of boredom, which looks at attention as the underlying mechanism. Essentially, you are in a state where you're unable to pay attention to the thing that you want to pay attention to, or you don't know what you want to pay attention to, and so you're frustrated and you get bored. That's sort of an interesting way to locate boredom in the brain. And there's a lot being done right now in trying to understand boredom a little bit better and trying to figure out exactly where it lives in the brain. There is an idea that it's in the sort of frontal orbital cortex area, which is where things like reward live and decision-making and attention, which seems to make sense. But again, all of these things need to be borne out a little bit more scientifically.
We're talking to Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie. She's been doing a lot of research on boredom and wrote recently about the history of boredom. There are articles online at Smithsonian.com. So Dr. Eastwood that you mentioned is one person who studied boredom. Now, I mentioned the studies of factory workers done, I guess they began in about 1938. What came out of them and what were researchers looking for at that time?
That was one of a sort of series of studies that were done, mostly paid for by industry, that were looking at how factory workers dealt with the tedium of being factory workers. That particular piece of research discovered that the best way for people to not be bored at work was to do drugs, amphetamines and caffeine. And obviously things like that wouldn't really fly now, but it is sort of interesting to see how stimulants might affect someone's ability to pay attention and to maintain that attention.
You also spoke to a psychologist or some other kind of researcher who looked at the relationship between boredom and disgust in an evolutionary sense. Can you pull that apart for us a little?
That was really interesting. Dr. Peter Tuohy was a Canadian professor of classics, but he made a study of boredom and looked at a lot of the literature and the research that was out there. And he sort of came up with this idea that I think has been hit on in a number of other places as well, that there's an evolutionary reason for boredom. It's sort of a cousin of disgust. In the same way that when you see, say, mold on a piece of food, you're disgusted and you don't want to eat it. You know, I mean, it's sort of warning you away from something that might potentially be harmful for you. Boredom could act in the same sort of way as kind of an early warning system against harmful social situations. It's interesting, too, because if it is an evolutionary response, it's almost worked too well. I certainly think that there's a school of thought that maybe we're too afraid of being bored now. And I definitely feel that, again, you know, with my smartphone in my hand pretty much all the time.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because we talk a lot about how people create new ideas on this program. And sometimes there's a common theme of having to rest or lie fallow. You know, that idea of creating ideas by daydreaming, by looking out a train window or driving a familiar road, being kind of mindless.
Absolutely. There has been actually a lot of research into mind wandering and daydreaming as a way to kind of let your brain think over problems. And interestingly, I think in the last 15 years, there's been a lot of research done into what's called the resting state scan or the default state. And basically, they just popped a bunch of people into MRI scanners and looked at what their brains were doing when they weren't asked to do anything. So they're just sort of hanging out, not doing anything. And what they found is that there wasn't a really significant decrease in brain function. So meaning that your brain's actually still turned on. It's still working. It's still doing stuff at this point where you're not asked to do anything else. And so there is definitely a link between daydreaming and boredom, and then potentially a link from daydreaming to creativity and using that fallow time to change as an impetus to creativity, to learn, to do something else, to figure out how to not be bored.
So boredom is something we could actually aspire to on some level. You know, there is a benefit to it.
I think there's definitely a benefit in not pathologizing it and not being afraid of it. That's something that I feel like, that I personally feel, that I'm almost afraid of being bored. That, you know, I had to go stop off at the doctor's office today, and I brought 3 books. I definitely don't need to bring 3 books for a 20-minute wait, but I just wasn't sure, you know? So I think that there is something good to be found in boredom, definitely.
Will you be discussing this at your boredom conference next year?
I hope so. If they invite me to talk, it'd be great.
Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, thank you so much for filling us in today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, she is a freelance writer, and her article, The History of Boredom, is online at smithsonian.com. You'll find a link on our Facebook page.
I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board. I'm a lengthy monologue. I'm living like a dog. I'm bored. I bore myself to sleep at night. I bore myself in broad daylight, 'cause I'm bored. Just another slimy bore. I'm free to bore my well-bought friends and spend my cash until the end, 'cause I'm bored. I'm bored. I'm the chairman of the board. Sick. I'm sick of all my kicks.